Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist fellowship and a welcoming congregation. So our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. You are welcome. Our reading today is from Prosperity in the Very Long Run. It is a long format article. It's available online for free. He also has a number of books. This is by Ian Morris, who is our study today. The books are all available online and in your local library. This particular reading is from Prosperity in the Very Long Run, which is an argument against people he calls the great Malthusians, who say that human history looks like this. There's just like nothing, 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 nothing. And then we discover and everything gets amazing. And he says that's way too simplistic. There's way more interesting stuff happening in this section right here. And I think the reason why he argues against them is if you believe that all of this doesn't matter, and the only thing that matters is the fossil fuel and the kick, that justifies doing basically anything to preserve fossil fuels, right? Because life was nasty, brutish, and short forever, and then we figured out how to manipulate the environment, so we need to just keep doing this, or everything's going to go back to nasty, brutish, and short. He says, in the Middle East, the practical constraints of cultivating domesticated cereals by hand meant that no gardener can farm more than an acre or two, making it very difficult for even the most industrious to grow richer than anyone else. Somewhere around 6,300 BC, you'll notice that happens way before the Industrial Revolution. 6,300 BC, however, agriculturalists worked out how to harness domesticated cattle to plows, augmenting their own labor with the animals' muscles, doubling or tripling the amount of land a family could farm. Total energy capture grew faster, and prosperity along with it, allowing people to build superior homes and fill them with far more material goods. However, what grew fastest of all was the unevenness of the distribution of the fruits of that growth, particularly when farmers started breeding oxen, bigger specialized draft animals. Somewhere between 4,500 and 4,000 BCE, in a process archaeologists call the Secondary Products Revolution, farmers found countless new ways to process, store, and trade the fruits of their labors more efficiently. They invented sailing ships and wheeled carts, learned to weave fibers and wool into clothes, and started casting copper tools, weapons, and ornaments. They created symbols to mark and account for private property, and by 3300 BC or so had turned these into genuine writing. Managers took charge, making themselves into powerful chiefs as early as 4400 BCE. By 3100 BCE, Egyptian chiefs had become kings, so awe-inspiring that multitudes were apparently willing to believe their leaders were gods on earth. I've loved three books in my life. Well, more, I love four. Obviously, the Bible doesn't count. I didn't pick that one. That one was given to me. The first was Lord of the Rings. That was number one through junior high. Then a weed-smoking punk rock anarchist from my Latin class allowed me to reverently touch his copy of Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It was leather-bound. I had to be gentle. I was hooked on Douglas Adams, not weed. Recommendations for Isaac Asimov. So I went to the library and I found a whole shelf, and there were a bunch that started with foundation. So I grabbed the first one. Oh, here's my Douglas Adams. You can see how yellow. Lord of the Rings, gotta hand it off to my children in the divorce. So I grabbed the first one, the first Asimov with the name Foundation, because I wanted to read this series. I remember being shocked because I looked at this old paper book. Obviously, it'd been checked out a thousand times, very rounded on the edges. And on the front cover, there was no like laser guy. There was no curvy girl. There was no spaceship and lasers. There was a dude in a wheelchair staring directly out at you from inside a vault. I read the whole first chapter, read the three chapters in the stacks, on the floor, in the stacks. Spoiler alert, the book has only been out for half a century, so if you don't want to be surprised, cover your ears. His name is Harry Seldon, the dude in the wheelchair. His name is Harry Seldon, and he dies. I know that's shocking. It's a whole thing in this book. It happens over and over and over. Asimov introduces a really cool, really interesting character, and then they die. Because the whole point of Foundation is it isn't about a character, it's about generations of the life of the Foundation, which was a colony intentionally planted by Seldon to help people survive the collapse of the Galactic Empire. I made it three quarters through the book before I figured it out. My college roommates thought I was crazy because I'm sitting at the table with the dog-eared version of the book, and I'm going, no way. And I'm like writing notes and flipping pages, and there is no way. And I'm flipping back, and there's no way. And people are looking at me like, what the heck? I'm like, it's the fall of Rome. The whole book is about the fall. Well, it's not about the fall of Rome. It's about the 1,000 years after the fall of Rome and all that chaos and craziness we went through in Europe to go from the fall of Rome to something better. Asimov was looking at history and saying, what if all that craziness that happened, all those events and terrors that happened, what if they weren't just random chaos? What if they had to happen that way? What if there was some order or meaning behind it? So today's author that we're studying, Ian Morris, he's Harry Seldon, if Seldon were real, if he studied at Cambridge, and if he was actually a world-renowned scholar and historian and archaeologist. If you are interested in fact-checking him, which I recommend because this stuff is both complicated and disturbing. Start with why the West rules for now. The graphs are online. The book is peer-reviewed, and the jokes are very British. Morris is fascinated with big picture history, trends that last millennia. It's like Seldon. The idea that the chaos we see around us has order. I mean, it's still chaotic, it's still random, but it has the special kind of order that only appears when you back way, way up. Unless you think I'm fanboying his family, his primary claim, I kind of hate it. He says that morals are something we make up after the fact to justify whatever works, that in each age we write new morals to fit whatever works. I genuinely hate that. But it's a mark of maturity to hear things you don't like without losing your mind. And my New Year's resolution is to be occasionally mature. So here we go. Morris divides history into four stages: foragers, farmers, fossil fuels, and whatever we're about to step into. Each stage is defined by energy availability, what you eat, what you have, what you use. Nomadic foragers get access to about 4,000 to 5,000 calories per day. That's a backpack. They don't have to work very hard for it, and they live in relatively egalitarian societies, which makes sense, right? If your tribe is a dozen or two people and you're all basically related, and Kyle decides to act like a dictator, what happened to Kyle? Right? And if Kyle starts a giant army and marches toward the town to take everything back, everything I own fits in a backpack. I just walk away. If you sneak up on me in the middle of the night, bonk me over the head and take my stuff, like, good for you, happy with your backpack. What are you going to eat next week? Warfare doesn't work. Hierarchy doesn't work at that level. That doesn't mean life was great. Average life expectancy is about 30 years. We survive on the Stone Age equivalent, about $2 a day. I wouldn't volunteer for it if I had the choice, but we survived and we were by and large free. Those wandering foragers learned to domesticate plants and animals. That was the reading we just did, and everything changed. Farmers can't run. You have to stand firm and fight or starve. We always have done violence, but now we have so much food, we can use armies for it. That's fun. Those armies clash and consolidate to form cities and then kingdoms and then empires, which sounds worse, right? But on average, we live longer. Because the first thing a good king does, and you got to be a decent king or you don't get to be king for very long, the first thing a good king does is establish trade and peace. Egalitarian societies give way to hierarchical ones where soldiers enforce obedience. And then the priests explain why it all has to be that way. Imagine you're a peasant, feet in the mud, never seen or done anything that your dad never saw or did. But that day, you look up across the Nile and you see Pharaoh floating in a massive gilded ship, bigger than your house. Pharaoh sits on this gilded ship, guarded by shiny armor, served by rainbows of saffron and fabric. And then priests call through the incense, "Children, obey your parents. Slaves, obey your masters, thus saith the Lord." Would you really blame that peasant for going home and saying to their spouse, "Today I saw God"? That's the era of the farmers. It's the birthplace of warfare, slavery, and control. That's the part I hate. It turns morality into math. It justifies what ought to be never justified. He defends himself by saying, "I'm not saying it's right, it's just the thing that happened. I still hate it." A new era dawns when we find creative ways to drag sunlight out of the ground and burn it. The era of fossil fuel means that everything changes again. And if moving from wandering foragers to settled farmers produced a destruction of egalitarianism and a rise of inequality, then wouldn't you expect that transitioning from settled farmers to fossil fuels would complete that cycle and we would just lose all egalitarianism and we would be entirely hierarchical? But surprisingly, that doesn't. The energy moving is too fast, too much for even one king, even one nation. Things get chaotic again, and we play the old game. We divide into teams, only this time the teams aren't kings and empires, they're nations and companies. And just like last time, they eat each other at great cost until they settle into a new equilibrium. And then they discover to their shock and dismay that the fastest way to make money is not to create the biggest empire, it's to create the biggest market. And despite the people in power fighting it every step of the way, the news stories spread faster than you can kill them. freedom of religion, freedom of speech, family, innocent until proven guilty, one is above the law. Through blood and tears, women break free, and slaves break free, and colonies break free. That's the part I like. And again, religion justifies what already happened. Protestants replace the priesthood with the priesthood of all believers. And every person is required to understand and read scripture for themselves. Slavery goes from a godly requirement to the worst of sins. We used to burn witches, sell souvenirs at lynchings, and staff our factories with children. Now all of that turns our stomachs. And good. The new mega narratives of capitalism and communism replace the old stories. And to my pastor's ear, they sound vaguely religious. They require faith. They provide comfort. They predict the future poorly. Sounds like religion to me. We're on the edge of something new. If Morris is correct, every time we've reached the limits of the previous, we've experienced turbulence until we so different, we had to rewrite our minds. What would it be like to live in a world with 5 times, 10 times more energy per person available to everyone than we have today? We have no idea. Imagine you go back to one of those forager families and you tell them about your life. Hey, great, 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 great grandpa. This is what life is like now. I get up in the morning and I go do a job. What's a job? Well, there's this boss. What's the boss? And he pays me in money. What's money? And then if I do that for 40 years and I'm really lucky, I get to retire. What's retire? Well, it means that I get to go fishing whenever I want and work on my garden. Yeah, that's Tuesday. We do that all the time. Or you go back to the farming era. Go back to Rome or Kyoto and explain to the Lord how the slaves are all free and women have rights and we keep kings around for pets. They're like mascots. Explain paid overtime, I dare you. See how long you get to keep talking before you lose your head. When we're in a context, we can't understand, we can't imagine life outside of that context. We can draw some inferences from the previous moments of instability. They are, to use the old curse, interesting times. The first movers gain an advantage. They always press that advantage. Inequality spikes, and then something magical happens. Any guesses? Maybe they think they're smarter than they are, and they get to experience the joys of famine. Maybe they hold on too tightly and they get outcompeted by everybody else. Maybe they're just royal jerks forever and the rest of us find them some other job to do. It always happens. The inequality spikes and then magically it gets fixed. But here's where this change might be different. Every other time when the first mover takes advantage, we kick some sense in it. And I'm sorry, guys, but it usually is him. What if this time one digital intelligence gets smart enough to improve itself and then an hour later everything's just done? What if this time one company figures out how to upload themselves to the internet? Now we get Elon, but he never ever dies. Or what if we bounce off the carrying capacity of the planet and everything just gets so expensive we can't do that anymore? The threats are terrifying and real. This is what gives me hope. Even if this change is different, it won't be the end of the planet. She was here long before us. She'll keep going after we're gone. And it probably won't be the end of us, honestly. All the stuff that we're afraid of losing, for most of human history, they didn't have that. Most humans never even saw the world we take for granted. And they didn't miss it. But maybe it isn't horrible. Maybe we come out on the other side and it's literal Star Trek. Maybe we get to live where Asimov and Adams and Tolkien aren't just authors, they're prophets who predicted an unseen reality and helped make it real. We don't know. That's why it rightly feels uncertain. It could be nothing, it could be everything. All we know for sure is the old systems are popping at the seams, and it's time for something new. So today, we grind yesterday's ashes into a powder, and we mix them with justified tears for what might have been, and we use that ink to write a better story. There is no congregation better prepared for that than this one. So let's get to work. Now we have an opportunity for questions, comments, disagreements. And the only thing I would add to that is we need each other. That's the thing that we forget in this world. We have so much stuff that we forget the primary need, which is community. Yeah, if we could find a way to get cheap, clean energy, just remember how when COVID hit and we all had to stay inside. Do you remember the videos from Florence, Venice? Do you remember the videos from Venice after like 1 week and there's dolphins swimming up the channel? Because the people aren't constantly churning it up with their little boats. Like, it wouldn't take long for the world to look radically different if we had a better way to do the energy thing. Morris says that violence was very, very real at the forager stage. It was just interpersonal. There was a vendetta, there was raiding, there was familial abuse, there was a lot of violence. And something like 10 to 20% of human beings died at the hand of another human being at the forager level. The difference is that there were no armies. That once you get to farming societies, what started as raiding dens and vendettas becomes actual armies fighting. And I did address this in the talk. Once the king gets to the top, the first thing the king does is enforce the peace. And so after a period of instability, they create the boundaries that allow prosperity to grow. They increase the amount of energy available to everybody and the lifespan of everybody. And the incidence of interpersonal violence drops while the number of, or while the violence and terror of the wars becomes even more ferocious. He would point towards periods within history where we have rolled back the energy budget and gone from farmers back into foragers. Like, that has happened multiple times through history. So he's not a fan of this, like, onward projection, like the history leans toward justice. He says, no, like, it's all evolutionary. It's the survival of whoever happens to survive. Yeah, there was, I mean, we're talking about such big ideas. There was so much I had to cut in the talk. And one of the ideas that was in an early draft that had to get cut was the it's a different author. That's why I cut it. It's not Morris. It's a different author who talks about a surplus of elites. He says, like, and it's sort of like the good times make good people, and then good people make easy times, and then easy times make bad people. You've heard that? Like, lazy people, and then the lazy people screw it up, and then the bad times make the good people. It's just this big cycle. It's similar. It's that kind of a concept. His idea was we develop prosperity, and the people who come out on the top of that fight, they become the elites, and then they capitalize on what they've created, and they have children and they multiply, and you wind up with a surplus of elites. And then they commit internecine warfare to decide who's going to be in charge next. So, and that he, I don't wish I remember the dude's name. If you Google surplus of elites, I guarantee you it will come up. But that's one of the things he talks about is like the freedom and the privilege to think about things is part of what drives people to be discontent.
Comment.
And that's the root of my disagreement with Morris, or my uncomfortability. It's not that I disagree with him. I'm not smart enough. I don't have the evidence to disagree with him. But I don't like it. And the place where it doesn't fit for me is like we have videos of capuchin monkeys getting pissed because they get stuff that's unfair. You know, you put the two monkeys in a cage and you give the one monkey lettuce and you give the other monkey a grape. And the monkey that gets the lettuce is like, screw you. And he starts shaking the cage. And okay, the understanding inequality and unfairness is inherent to sapience. Like there's something about being alive that, or part of our evolutionary branch, that makes us aware of that. We have empathy. Empathy isn't taught to us, empathy is natural. The critters do it too. Nobody taught them. So all of the learning stuff that we do is on top of a baseline of empathy. And he doesn't address any of that. He's just like, okay, well, stuff happened and it's math. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not right. It's not good. It needs to be better. And he's like, yeah, okay, but it didn't happen that way. And yeah, that's why I don't like it. Go in peace.